And good morning. Bill Handel here on a Monday morning, September 27th. John Hinckley Jr., unconditional release. The man who attempted to assassinate Ronald Reagan and was successful in killing James Brady, although that was years later. Reagan's press secretary shot in the head and suffered for many years. In any case, Hinckley, who was declared not guilty for reason of insanity, has been in and out of, well, in a mental institution and is unconditional release today. But that really doesn't say much, because for the last dozen years, he's been going to his mother's house on weekends and partial release. So this is just the next logical step. And you talk about one of the most high-profile, not guilty by reason of insanity defenses you have seen in the aftermath. The issue of wildfires, which is now an annual issue. We don't come up with wildfire season anymore, because you've heard over and over again, there's no such thing as wildfire season. It's 365 days a year. And there's still a couple of big ones going on. Lake Tahoe, that's almost a million acres going on right now. That's gone down. That's the Dixie Fire. The Caldor Fire, 216,000 acres. 2020 was the record-setting U.S. fire season. Almost 10,000 structures went up in flames, and we know it's going to get worse. So why don't we just run away? Well, it's a little more complicated, because at first glance, you go, okay, we're done living in wildfire areas, particularly when you can't even get insurance anymore. Can't even get fire insurance. So why do people do it? Well, because it's not in my backyard. It's not me. It's over there. Those are the people going to burn up. And people just want to move into these areas, wildfire-prone areas. Because it's beautiful. You got forest growth. You got greenery. Well, not so much when it turns brown and it burns up. So it seems like an obvious solution. Why don't we just move, retreat from those areas? Well, the reality is a lot more complicated than just getting out, because you just don't leave. There's managed retreat, who, how often, relocation. That's one of the tools in the toolkit. This is in the toolkit. This is a social scientist from RAND who studied this. Because if people decide to pull up stakes, and there are plenty of people that make all the logic to me to leave. I'm not, you know, how many times can you be caught up in a fire area? How many times can you be caught up in a flood where you say, okay, I'm out of here? That's a tool to get out, but you've got to find someplace else to live, because every part of the U.S. is facing climate change impact. Everyone, whether it's rainfall, storm surges, heat, in the case of Southern California, even the non-fire areas, we get the earthquakes or earthquake. There's no place that has zero exposure to natural disasters. It just doesn't exist. So here's what experts want people to do. Rethink what it means to prepare for the worst. You know, think of the ways, for example, wildfires can be managed and actually controlled over time. Philosophy has been some part of the forest or some part of the neighborhood catches on fire, or, let's say a forest area where there's plenty of homes. And so what do? They extinguish the fires as quickly as possible. Well, if you go back thousands of years, the indigenous people, they actually dealt with the fire-prone areas by prescribed burns. They would actually start burning up the place. And why would they do that? Well, because that's effective. Because when you have a wildfire in an area that's been dry for, I don't know, dozens of years, 50 years, 100 years, man, you've got the fuel, the kindling that just explodes, and all of a sudden you have a million-acre fire that's spreading like wildfire. And so we know that effective burns reduce the extent of the fire, the severity of the fire, how quickly it grows. And it is, and this goes back, I mean, control burns, and you see these, the fire workers, the firefighters taking these cans, and you can just see them spraying gasoline or whatever flammable liquid, and then just having these prescribed burns. Why? Because you've got the fire, the brush that is now burnt up. It doesn't expand to areas that it shouldn't. It also allows the bigger plants, when these prescribed burns, it gets rid of the shrubbery, it gets rid of the brush, it gets rid of the trees, for example, that are saplings, and when they dry out, they become more fuel. So you've got the prescribed burns, which have been going on forever, and the native Indians used to do that. We also have fire-resistant materials that have proven effective, but underused. Local, state, national laws can be passed. I mean, one of the things here in Southern California, I remember years ago when it must have been 35 years ago when the county of Los Angeles, maybe it was the city, but I think it was the county of Los Angeles, they made it illegal to put wood shingles on homes. If you go back, especially in the San Fernando Valley 30 years ago, every single house would have wood shingles. And they passed a law saying, no, no more wood shingles because they're too prone to be ignited by embers, fires. And so big deal, right? Well, the average roof lasts about 30, 35 years. So guess what? You don't see shingles anymore on homes. They don't exist. Wood shingles you don't see. And that's the government coming in and mandating a reasonable attempt to control the fires. And the vast majority of these fires, it used to be the embers would catch on roofs and boy, it'd explode. So we've got these massive wildfire stems, and that's not from regular fires. They come in and all of a sudden, everything explodes because we didn't do a good job of managing the forests. When President Trump talked about the rakes, and we all made fun of him. Well, I mean, that particular statement was kind of funny, but there is such a thing as wildfire management, forest management. But you know what it costs in order to do a decent job? It's about $1 million per acre. That's what the U.S. Forest Service estimates. $1,000 per acre to lessen fire risk. $1,000 an acre, which doesn't seem like a horrible amount, except right now, 80 million acres of federal land are overdue for fire mitigation work. That's 80 million acres of federal land. So we're talking in the hundreds of billions of dollars in terms of fire mitigation. And do we have the wherewithal? Do we have the money? Well, we could, because it's a question of priorities. What do we do? I mean, where do we spend our money? Because in the end, you know, I've said this, in the end, it's almost impossible to govern a large bureaucracy. There's too many choices have to be made. Resources have to be allocated. Every group gets pissed off if they don't get what they want or what they perceive they need. And the wildfire is just part of it. It's going to get worse. Right, we know that with the climate change. Now, there are some mitigating factors. We can go into forest management. We can certainly make it more difficult or make it tougher in terms of building restrictions, although we're pretty close right now. And it's an ongoing battle, and maybe changing the way we look at our fire practices. Because what does happen if a fire comes up immediately, let's say you have a forest fire, or let's say you have a campfire at a national forest or a state park, and all of a sudden it ignites the brush around it, someone calls 911, the fire authorities are immediately informed, and out comes the airplane, and they extinguish the fire because they don't want to take a chance. Well, that means prescribed fires, that means that natural fires caused by lightning, for example, don't happen anymore. And those are needed to make it all work. In other words, we're throwing the ecology all out of whack, not that we haven't done before. So that's a story that we're going to come up with over and over again. I talk to Dean Sharp about this all the time in terms of reducing the risk. Bill Handel here on a Monday morning, September 27. Some of the big stories that are trending. John Hinckley, unconditional release today. He is out and done after having attempted to assassinate Ronald Reagan. And, of course, James Brady, the press secretary, who he shot in the head, who died in several years later. All right. Now, I'm going to throw something at you, a stat, which is not surprising, but I want to bring it home. And the murder rate last year in the U.S. spiked by 30%. So far, 2021, murders are up nearly 10% in major cities. Matter of fact, the 2020 increase alone is the largest percentage increase ever recorded in America. So what's going on? Well, you can blame COVID. You can claim the politics and the polarization. You can blame any number of factors. The trick is, how do we deal with it? What do you do with these numbers, the increase of murders and violent crimes? Well, there is only one good piece of evidence that actually has some scientific backing here. And that is one approach that has that very good evidence in dealing with the murders and crime: more police. That's it. More police. Solid evidence that more police officers and policing strategies reduce crime and violence. It's not that complicated. Right? There was a recent survey of criminal justice experts, and the majority said increase police budgets, improve public safety. The more police you throw out there, the more you're going to see crime going down. Now, that is contrary to the defund the police in progressive circles, which focuses on cutting policing and boosting alternatives. Right? Here's the problem. There is almost no evidence out there of any magnitude that shows that the alternative to policing, taking money out of police budgets and using it in more of a social-oriented program, social workers, et cetera, whether that actually does anything to reduce crime. Not that the evidence isn't there. It's just putting more cops on the street tomorrow means crime drops tomorrow. Switching over to a social system, social-based system of policing, social workers, negotiators, de-escalators, that sort of thing. Those take a very long time. Takes a long time to implement them. It takes a long time to study the results. And the only evidence we have out there is you put more cops on the street, you're going to see less crime. Now, there are ways of putting more cops on the street, and maybe that's exactly it, putting more cops on the street. And when you talk about local policing, this fantasy that we have is a local cop on the beat who would walk the beat and everybody in the neighborhood knows who he is. And he knows everybody on a first name basis. And that's local policing. That's when police were admired. That's when they were put on pedestal. Pedestals, of course, those days are long gone. But the bottom line is the more police cars, the more police officers you see on the streets, crime simply goes down. Even if nothing is being done, just watching a policeman, how many criminals are going to be doing their work as criminals if there's a cop on the corner? So now there is a fight going on between the, well, there's three different issues here. Issue number one is the argument that we simply need more cops on the street. You know, we can train them, we can do the de-escalation business, we can do all that. We simply need more cops on the street. And that deters crime in and of itself. The other argument is we don't need more cops on the street. What we need is more social programs, working with potential would-be criminals, after-school programs, all of that, which, again, long, long term. And then fighting the philosophy that cops are inherently bad, that police, by definition, are evil. And we never used to have that. But when you look at the Black Lives Matter movement, and I'm not talking about the entire movement, when you're talking about portions of it, you're talking about the most vocal aspects of it, police are evil. It's that simple. And the fewer police we have out there, the better off we are. And if we replace police with these social programs, we have social workers, we have school programs, we have money put into training programs, keeping kids off the street, that is going to do it. To the point where we're going to need almost no police. Whoa. Yeah, boy, that's going to work. So I want to leave you with this, that the only hardcore evidence that we have that the scientists can look at, the social scientists can look at, In terms of policing and what works and doesn't work, there is one piece of evidence that stands out, and that is the more police that are out there on the streets, the less crime is committed, simply by sheer numbers. Coming up, do they have a case with Wayne Resnick? Love doing this, ending a Monday show with that. We'll be right back with Wayne. This is KFI AM 640 live everywhere on the iHeartRadio app. There's Jennifer Jones-Lee.
Gavel time. The banging of the gavel when Bill Handel says if they have a case. Oh, yeah, it's gavel time. We know Bill Handel can't be a real judge.
It is a Monday, September 27th. Bill Handel here and the rest of the morning crew. We've got a lot going on today. San Diego police are investigating the deaths of that woman and her two-year-old son. They fell from the third level of Petco Park. No idea what happened there, other than it is suspicious, is the term that's being used. And then the family and friends of Gabby Petito gathered in Long Island yesterday. Thousands showed up at a memorial service. All right, now let's do it. It's Do They Have a Case with Wayne? Haven't done this in a while. Wayne Resnick, who, as you know, has spent a good part of his life in the criminal justice system, so he knows this stuff pretty well, and researches the case, comes up and says, here's what's going on, which way should the courts or did the courts rule, and it's a case of first impression for all of us, meaning that we haven't heard of it before. And in many cases, there's no law on it, and we still have to decide.
All right, this is a sordid story. And it has to do with a bunch of highly educated medical researchers working at a lab. The lab is funded mostly by grants that it gets to do research. So you have the guy who runs the lab, Dr. Robert Garfield. Boom. Then you have one of the doctors that works there, William Maynor. He is the aggrieved party here. He's the guy who's upset. You've also got a couple other doctors there, Dr. Wan and Dr. Shi. Now, Garfield, who runs the whole thing, is in an affair with Dr. Shi. Takes her to professional conferences and stuff that he does not invite anybody else to, for example. And they're not keeping it a secret. They live together, and they even have PDAs at work. All right. At some point, they decide to move the lab from Texas to Arizona. So they moved the lab from Texas to Arizona, and Garfield wants everybody to come along. But Maynor can't go to Arizona because, and please don't let this prejudice your judgment of the case, he can't move to Arizona because he gets convicted of a lewd act crime with his own child and has to stay in Texas for 8 years of probation.
Why would that prejudice anything?
Well, because that's not a nice thing that he did, is
okay,
it?
Okay, no, you know? Probably not, yes.
But Dr. Garfield says, that's okay, we'll put a little office in Galveston and you can work remotely. So that's now the situation, all right? Everybody else is in Arizona. Garfield is still whooping it up with Dr. Shi, and Maynard's back in Texas. Well, his work starts to suffer, and he gets written up for doing bad work. And eventually, they eliminate his position. He sues and says it is sex discrimination under Title VII. He goes to the EEOC. Sex discrimination. Well, how is it sex discrimination? Well, Dr. Shi is still there, and she, S-H-I, is a she. And I'm gone, and I'm a guy. And that is sex discrimination. And the court says, what are you talking about? And here's his theory. It's called paramour preference discrimination. This is when you feel you're being discriminated against in the workplace because the boss is romantically involved with somebody else. So here's the problem. The lab company says, Title VII only says you can't be discriminated against based on race, religion, and sex, meaning your gender.
Right.
You weren't nothing happened to you because of your gender. Yes, it's true. He is stooping this other worker, but that's not you're not protected So who's right here?
I don't think he's got much of a case arguing under sex discrimination, because especially if there are valid reasons for him to have been fired. And, for example, the validity of the write-ups, you know, has his work suffered? And I'm assuming that during the course of a trial to bring up some evidence. No, he just did that to screw me over. No, the work actually did suffer. But the bottom line is I absolutely agree with the lower court that said it's not a protected class. It just so happens that he's a guy and the boss is shtupping some woman. And what if the boss was shtupping some guy? Whoa, is that sex discrimination too? So I don't know where he's going with this. I think that he has no case.
He has no case. And also, the Ninth Circuit now finally joins every other circuit. You see, this paramour preference thing has been tried a lot. I didn't get promoted because the boss is sleeping with that person. It's been tried over and over again. Every time it goes to a federal appeals court, they say, nope, there's no such thing under federal law. It's just the Ninth Circuit, I guess, didn't have a case until now. So they've joined every other federal court. No, there's nowhere to go in this country now and try this. I got discriminated against because of the romantic relationship that my boss is in. Nobody's saying that it's cool if that happens to you. They're just saying the law doesn't cover it.
Yeah, and also that. I mean, even if the law did cover it, I think they'd have a hard time connecting the dots here because it's ignoring the fact that the work was substandard. Oh, no, there's no such thing as my work being substandard. All the write-ups that you gave me were ridiculous. They were, you just did that because you hate me because you're discriminating against me. It doesn't work that way. Also, I mean, it's a little bit of an issue. You're going to take in front of a jury, and has it come out that you had sex with one of your own children and were convicted of it and therefore on probation? That's going to fly, isn't it?
Well, and that's the reason why he couldn't move to Arizona with everybody else. They were perfectly happy to have him.
Yeah, this is a particularly bad case for the plaintiffs.
I'm surprised that he got somebody to pursue it for him this far. Like, if you were an attorney and somebody said, I want to go to federal court and I want to sue and here's what happened, would you want to get on board with that?
You'd be surprised how many lawyers take cases in which there is no chance whatsoever. That's happened to me a couple of three times when I was sued on a surrogacy matter, and the case was so blatantly in completely insane that on the courthouse steps, they dismissed because they weren't going to go even in trial. And I asked the lawyer, I said, what are you doing here? You know, this makes no sense. And it was, we thought we'd get publicity out of it.
Oh, okay.
Okay, there's that one reason.
Sure.
And another one's because they, well, almost extorted, saying, oh my God, you know, you look at you and, you know, all the horrible things you say on radio, and we don't want to bring those up. And I go, get in line.
They forgot that you have no shame.
That's correct.
So trying to shame you,
I know, it just didn't work. Yeah, it's true. But anyway, so the point is, it makes no sense that that could have made sense. It doesn't.
So maybe the lawyer thought they'd make a name for themselves if they could get a favorable rule. Look
maybe.
What I did.
Yeah,
I had sex
maybe.
Discrimination against this guy.
Who knows? Who knows? Well, lawyers are weird. All right. Take a break, come back, and we'll finish up. Do they have a case with Wayne Resnick and me? Let's check in with Jennifer Jones Lee. And we're back, everybody. Bill Handel here. It is a Monday morning, September 27, as we end the show. And it is, do they have a case with Wayne Resnick? Wayne, let's move forward.
All right, Handel's choice. Problem with a murder trial or problem with a lady taking videos and photos at the park and there's children?
Oh, let's do murder.
All righty. And this is also a local case from here in Southern California.
Better.
So a guy is murdered, and pretty quickly the cops zero in on some suspects and arrest them, and they go to trial. No eyewitnesses, no direct evidence linking these two guys to this murder. The evidence is almost entirely the testimony of an informant who says, oh, on Tuesday, that guy told me he killed the guy. And on Wednesday, that guy told me he also was involved in the killing of the guy. So they have a preliminary hearing, and this informant, you know, says that they both confessed to me that they killed a guy. They start asking the informant about some of his troubles, and he takes the fifth. Now they get to trial. Here comes the informant. Now he decides he's taking the fifth on everything. He is not going to say anything about anything. So the judge says, well, the witness is unavailable. He's unavailable by virtue of taking the fifth. So when a witness is unavailable, you can read their preliminary hearing testimony. So he reads the testimony from the preliminary hearing to the jury. But of course, the guy's not there to be asked anything. And the jury convicts them. And now they appeal and they say, hey, you have a constitutional right to confront the witnesses against you. And here we are at the actual trial. You're reading his testimony. He's not even there. Nobody can confront him. It's a clear constitutional violation. And the government says, hey, there was opportunity to cross-examine him at the preliminary hearing, and that's good enough. Now it's in front of a federal appeals court. Is that good enough?
I don't think so. I think that the ability to confront witnesses at trial, it may encompass a preliminary hearing, but to the exclusion of everything but a preliminary hearing, I don't think that's going to fly. The ability to confront a witness is so fundamental to our Constitution and to our system of justice that it's sacrosanct. And if you don't have a witness there to confront, where do you go other than the testimony that's read in? You can't refute it other than standing up and testifying in a trial that you don't have to testify to. In other words, defendants don't have to say anything, and they never do. So therefore, I guess the argument would be the only way they could refute it is for them to stand up and refute it. And therefore, they're part of the case in which they're constitutionally not forced to be in. That's the way I view it. A little convoluted, but the bottom line is I don't think that is the ability to confront a witness. So I'm going to say that the defendant wins on this one.
That was a cogent, passionate presentation that you just made about the fundamental constitutional right to confront the witnesses against you. But apparently, you're wrong.
This is where I don't know.
Can you believe it?
Yeah, and I don't. I don't understand that. I really don't.
Here's the thing, okay? You know that there's virtually no right that is 100% all the time, right? Like, you have a right to free speech. That doesn't mean they can't have a law that says you can't use a 50,000-watt amplifier for your protest. You have a right to have a gun in your house for protection. It doesn't mean you have the right to walk around the streets with a machine gun. You have a right to confront witnesses, but it doesn't mean that you can. I want to find the quote. There's actually a Supreme Court case that says the right, you don't have a right to cross-examination. I'm paraphrasing now. You don't have a right to cross-examination anytime, anywhere, any way you want, to the extent that you might want. You have a right to some kind of basic confrontation.
Yeah.
And
you had it at
the preliminary hearing.
So how about at trial to confront witnesses? Are they ignoring that completely?
Well, I guess they consider the preliminary hearing part of the trial. Here's the quote. This is the Supreme Court. The Confrontation Clause does not confer an unlimited right to cross-examination that is effective in whatever way and to whatever extent the defense might wish. So you don't decide when you've had enough cross-examination. The court decides when you've had enough. And this judge decided they'd had enough. And these three judges over there agreed that they had enough. Now, here's the thing about this.
Which I don't understand.
It's going to be a case-by-case question. It's because part of it is going to have to do with, well, if he had been on this stand, what would you have confronted him about? And here, one thing is, at the preliminary hearing, he already admitted that he was getting paid by the police. And if he had been on the stand at the trial, they would have brought up another payment, an extra payment. And they said, but if the jury already knew that he had been paid. So what are you adding to that? And then the other thing is that the detectives actually opined that he was not a reliable informant. And we would have confronted him about that. And the court said, but you don't even know if he knew that they thought he was unreliable. So part of it has to do with the specifics of what you would have brought up.
Crazy. All right. Well, one for two, but I would go two for two if I had my druthers on that one. Tomorrow, we're back again. Same crew. And I'll be here at, I think, I'll be here for most of the show. I'm trying to figure out when I start coming back from 6 to 10. It's going to be another couple of days when the show goes back to absolutely normal. Take care, everybody. Catch you in the morning. This is KFI AM 640 live everywhere on the iHeartRadio app.